Welcome to the Wise Life Podcast. My name's Dina Morris and I'm a yoga teacher and hypnotherapist here to help you get the best out of life, sharing tools, tips and tactics for powerful aging with wisdom and joy. Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to start with a question today on the Wise Life Podcast. Are you eating al desco more often than not? And if you haven't come across that phrase, basically it means rather than sitting down to eat a meal at a table with maybe even a knife and fork, are you sitting in front of a laptop and trying to work while you're eating? If that's a yes, then today's podcast may well be for you, because I am delighted that I'm going to be welcoming in a moment Laurie from the Mindful Eating Clinic, who has developed programs to help us move away from some of those unhealthy habits and relationships with food. Her programs come from need. Her background is decades of disordered eatings, and she thought that she would live a life on diets for life. But Laurie has found her way of changing her relationship with food, and she's now developed the Mindful Eating Clinic. It's never too late to change, Laurie says. And if you want to check out her website, themindfuleatingclinic.com, and look at my story page, you'll find a video where Laurie talks about her relationship with food. If you know yours is disordered, take heart, because you are not alone. So Laurie, I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. So exciting.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm particularly interested in the mindful eating aspect of the cornucopia of stuff that you do, because let's face it, you're a multi-talented, multitasking woman. Mindfulness clearly rings a lot of bells for yoga teachers, and food, you would think, would be a mindful experience for us, and yet clearly it is not. And I suspect over lockdown that has become increasingly evident to some people. So could you just give us an overview of what mindful eating is to start?
Sure. Yes, of course. And in fact, I was reflecting on this before I was due to come on and chat to you. And I was thinking about the connection and the synergy actually between mindful eating and yoga and that kind of mindfulness practice, and thinking that it is very much about being in the moment and connecting and being non-judgmental and not comparing and not thinking about anyone else's relationship with what they're doing. And yoga is like that. And that's what mindful eating is partly about. So it's about reconnecting with the consciousness of what we're eating, but also very largely about how we are eating. So things like eating at a slow pace, things like tapping into our intuitive ability to know whether we're hungry or we're full and or we are full. It's about savoring the food that we're eating, and there's some appreciation that comes into that as well. It's about taking time, but having space around our relationship with food to make it into something that is as special as possible. And even if that means it's just about taking yourself away from your laptop at lunchtime to have 15 minutes between you and a bowl of salad, you know, that's still mindful eating. Because if we're eating al desco, as a nutritionist friend once called it, which I absolutely love.
You used the phrase, yeah.
It's brilliant, isn't it? If we're eating al desco, then we are distracted and we're not connecting with that operation, with that eating process. And that's beneficial in itself because it slows everything down. It's good for our digestion if we eat slowly, because we're chewing a lot more in the mouth, and that's where the digestion starts. It's where the flavor comes out we can't taste anything once we swallow it. So the longer it stays in our mouth, the more we can appreciate the flavors and the texture of the food. The element of staying connected and conscious also means that we have this awareness of what we are eating. And quite often, if people, for example, have been on diets for quite a large part of their life, then they're eating with their brains because their brain is overriding their instinctive preferences for food, quantity, timing, taste, nutrition, all of that. I've slightly lost my thread now. What was I going to go on?
And I'm just sitting here nodding, going, so much sense.
Yes, that's right. Now it's come back to me, sorry, yes. And also, the thing that a lot of my clients have is that, particularly if they overeat or they binge, a lot of those messages are coming from the subconscious. So it's learned behavior. And it might be because that's how they've looked after themselves or how other people have looked after them. And we can talk about any of these things in a bit more detail. And so the mindful eating brings it much more to the forefront of the conscious mind and helps us have a dialogue with ourselves, which sounds a bit loopy when you first hear it, but it is absolutely the only way to try and change this habitual conversation that we have in our head. So you asked for an overview. I'm not sure that was an overview, but anyway.
It makes absolute sense. As a hypnotherapist as well, that dialogue between the conscious mind and the subconscious, as we know, the subconscious is driving maybe 7/8 of our behavior. We're just unaware of how prevalent subconscious triggers and drivers are for us. A lot of those triggers and drivers around food, I feel, get set when we're very young. And of course, we're pure subconscious at that when we're small, aren't we? It's in order to make sure that we don't wander off, we stay close to our parents, we listen to them and what they say, we don't question whether sending your dinner to children in Africa makes any sense whatsoever, whether you finish it or not. So we just do as we're told and we eat beyond what is sensible for us if we have parents who grew up at a time as ours did, as we're 50 plus women, during or post Second World War, where there were real food shortages. And food was a real driver for our parents' generation, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely, so, yes. And my grandmother had that starving children in Africa conversation with me regularly. But I think it's also important to understand that all of that upbringing came out of a place of compassion and out of love. And certainly with my grandmother, because there wasn't the food to put on the table when my mother was young, that feeding of us was her love language. You know, that's how she wanted to express how much she loved us. So I have to look back on that very fondly and say, that's what the intention was. The intention was good, even though it can muck about with how we distort our relationship with food. And also things like, you know, granny's always the one that's going to give you chocolate if you fall over, and give you chocolate if you get a gold star at brownies, and give you chocolate for any other reason under the sun. So it becomes a treat food in our head, doesn't it?
True. Nobody gives you broccoli, do they?
No.
And I don't know about you, but I cannot. I mean, I knew that my grandparents loved me, but I can't remember them actually ever saying the words. You know, there wasn't that love language of, you know, I love you so much, you're such an amazing child. You know, there was a bag of bonbons in my case.
Yes.
Bags of sweets.
Oh, was it? I remember my grandfather saying things to me like, "You'll do, sunshine. And that was probably his version of saying, "You're my favourite grandchild.
All the words.
I love
all
you."
The words. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant. So getting this idea of mindful eating makes absolute sense. Because I talk in yoga, we're always trying to explain to our students that the end posture is not the yoga. The yoga is in the journey to the end posture. The end posture is just the full stop. And to stop obsessing about the full stop, because the end of the sentence will get there eventually.
Yes.
Even in my sentences that can ramble on forever with numerous subclauses and tangents. However, the journey there is what's important. And that can be some stopping and starting and moving forward and stepping back. Your experience of creating the Mindful Eating Clinic, this didn't just like pop into your head one day, did it? I've had a look at your website and you have a really lovely piece about yourself and your life in Ross on Wye with your five sheep and your vegetable garden. And then there's this lovely video where you talk about yourself and your own experience and the reality of what it's like to come from a disordered eating background. Mm. You clearly had at some point the light bulb moment where you thought, this is just enough. This has to stop.
Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you began to feel your way through to what you've now created as the Mindful Eating Clinic?
Yes, yeah, sure. So, yeah, so I had disordered eating for 40 years.
That's a long time, Laurie.
That's a long time. And through all of that, managed careers, I managed performing, I was amateur, semi-pro singer, and I had a corporate training career, I had two children, you know, all of that stuff. But the reality is that a lot of people manage, live perfectly well with disordered eating in the background, particularly when they don't have a fully blown eating disorder, which is physically crippling, like anorexia, for example. You can live with yo-yo dieting. It's not very constructive at all, but you can. So I got to 56, because I knew when it started, I was 16. I got to 56 and I said, hang on a minute. This is 40 years, on and off, you know, good and bad periods, but on and off, it's never been far away. And I just thought, that is enough. You're an intelligent woman. You must be able to address this and sort it out. And so I took a step back and I thought, right, what would I do if I was a third party? How would I talk to myself? How would I try to unpick it? I did a lot of reading about intuitive eating, about mindfulness, about the damage of diet culture. And I realized that I wasn't alone, which is quite a big moment when you think, right, okay, I'm not a freak. There are lots of people out there who have disordered eating, which has been exacerbated hugely by dieting, because during that part of my life, there's no coverage. And obviously we didn't have internet until relatively recently in our lives. So there was no way to find out about any other way of treating what I had, which I now know was binge eating disorder. And so I read a lot, I researched a lot, I used my own NLP training, neuro-linguistic programming that I've used on corporate clients. I broke it down. I just took it step by step. I threw away every diet book I had. I got rid of all the notebooks, because anyone who's listening to this who has had a similar experience will know that every Sunday night or every other Sunday night, you start a new notebook. And the fact that it's a new notebook obviously means that it's going to work this time. Of course it is. And it's a different color and you've got a different pen and you're going to write it differently, you know, and everything's going to be okay. Whereas in fact, it's not going to change a thing. It's just going to make you feel even worse, because there's yet another notebook that becomes redundant by the following Thursday or a week Thursday to add to the pile that you've already got. You could probably build the Taj Mahal with. So all of these things together made me work on it. And I shared it all with my husband. I shared it with a couple of other friends who had absolutely no idea. Nobody had any idea about it, because a lot of this disordered eating happens in private because there's a lot of shame around it.
I was going to say to you, what was that like to talk to people who from whom you've been hiding a secret, which for you I imagine felt like a fundamental vulnerability moment? It's very exposing, isn't it?
Yes. With my husband, there was huge relief because he's quite black and white about things, so there wasn't any judgment. He's also very pragmatic, and he said, right, what do we need to do then? So he was really great. It was really interesting, actually. So one friend was very warm about it and said, gosh, I had no idea, I wish I'd known and I would have supported you. And then another friend actually said, why didn't you tell me? You've had this part of your life and I didn't know about it. And actually was quite resentful that I hadn't told them, which is quite interesting, isn't it? How people relate to you keeping secrets from them. Yeah. But what that meant was that I actually felt like I, once I'd actually, in fact, I didn't talk a huge amount about it until I made myself better. And that took about 3 months, which actually isn't that long, because it all made such sense to me. All this stuff I was reading about natural weight set points and the hormones that tell us whether we're hungry and whether we're full and how dieting mucks about with it, it all made perfect sense. And because of that, it all slotted into place. And my conscious mind was able to take over. I distanced myself from my greedy gremlin. So this persona in my
head. Is that what you call it? You've got a personality.
Yeah. In fact, I've got a picture of him on my board here. He's still here. And I kind of, you know, make a gesture.
Wave two fingers at him.
Now and again. Yeah. Yes, I do. So I externalized him. And he is a he. Sorry, guys, anyone that's listening. But he is a he. And actually that process that I help clients with is one of the most beneficial things for them, because then it means that their eating does not define them. Their eating is a separate behavior. It's not a part of their identity. It's something that they do rather than something that they are.
And that must release a lot of the shame, because you're no longer thinking there's something wrong with me.
Exactly. Or
there's something wrong with Bob over there.
Exactly. Bob, Charlie, Cynthia, it doesn't really matter what this thing is called. And then you can start talking to it and you can put it to bed and you can, you know, shift it to one side. So anyway, so I got to that point. I sorted myself out. I went public on Facebook because I just felt like
what was that like? Yeah.
Good, actually. Good. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of me sort of thought, oh gosh, is this a bit self-indulgent? Should I really be doing this? And I thought, no, hang it. I feel like I don't want to have the secret from anybody. And if people are not interested in reading it, then that's fine. But I felt like I wanted people to know. And then I felt so passionate about it. And interestingly, not regretful that I had spent a long time in disordered eating, because I thought, well, that's just how it is. Because I always think if you can not regret stuff, that's quite good, because it's not a very helpful emotion. And I found myself naturally not regretting, but wanting to help anyone spend less time than I had in that situation. You know, even if it's a year less, it doesn't really matter.
I think that there's something very interesting about this sort of midlife wake up that people have. We seem to, I don't know whether it's a menopause, postmenopause, hormonal, you're not like spinning around this cycle of every 4 weeks of up and down and where am I today-ness, that you suddenly start getting some clarity about who you are and who you want to be. And sometimes you can go through periods of blind incandescent rage about the amount of time that you've wasted pandering to an overculture that isn't serving you in any way, shape or form other than meeting its own needs. And sometimes you can just like bob on and go, well, you know, ta-da, learned the lesson. Life's all about learning and I'm taking this forward with me now.
Yeah.
But you were saying about letting go of your notebooks of your Monday morning diet starts, of which you've said, you know, there were many stuffed in those drawers. How many diet books did you have? Because I'm willing to bet I've probably heard of most of them, if not owned them at some point myself. They seem to be everywhere in the 80s and 90s and noughties, didn't they?
Yes, everywhere. I mean, I don't know how many I've had in total, because I've probably gone through phases of getting rid of some when I felt that I'd failed them rather than, in fact, them failing me, you know, or they hadn't worked. But, oh, gosh, every single one, you know, Atkins, F-Plan, you know, all of them. I've done Weight Watchers. I mean, I can remember sitting at my desktop computer then on a Sunday night, having had the most horrendous, in my mind, most horrendous eating for maybe a week or so, and been absolutely desperate and gone onto the internet and searched for something and signed up to Weight Watchers there and then, you know, with tears streaming down my face because just so desperate to put it right. And that's all we had then. You know, now there's this new-ish movement to say, you know, that there is a much more natural, healthy way to manage your weight, whatever that healthy weight is. And that's a conversation I think that it's quite important to have with women of our age. You know, the chances are you're not going to weigh the same as you did when you were 18. You've been through life experience. You're certainly not going to be the same shape that you were when you were 18. You know, and if you've had a family, that's for sure going to have distorted something going on. We're not all Kate Middleton, you know. So you know, there's lots of perspective around that. And so I do help women lose weight. I don't think the desire to lose weight is a dirty word, although, you know, there are some schools of thought out there that say we should just love our bodies irrespective. I think health, you know, needs to be a consideration. If someone is carrying a lot of weight, then it's going to be healthier for them to get rid of that, or to at least reduce it down. But I think that those goals, going back to what you said earlier, actually, which I thought was such an important point, that actually it's not so much about a numerical goal with a weight where you might get to an end weight and go, that's great, finished, what do I do now? In fact, the mindful eating is an endless journey, an endless process, and through that process, if you have excess weight to lose, you will lose it.
It's a practice rather
than absolutely right
DIY project.
Yes, and if I talk to people, I talk in quite therapeutic terms, because it's also an holistic approach. So whatever I encourage someone to do to improve their eating behaviors, it has to make sense to them. And if there are practical recommendations, it has to fit in with their lifestyle and all of that kind of stuff. And sometimes I start, you know, from a point of how do they feel about themselves? Where are they in their lives? Why now? And how ready are they for the change? And how open are they to the fact that there will be setbacks and there will be relapses? And talk about their perspective of, you know, how much of a relapse one chocolate hobnob really is in the scheme of things, because it isn't. It's just a chocolate hobnob, you know, and all these sorts of holistic adjustments, really, psychological adjustments, you know, that help somebody start to experience the grey and less of the black and white. And if someone has a dieting history, it can be very all or nothing, very black and white.
It's very sort of catastrophizing industry, isn't it? It's based on performing. And there is only, I was going to say up, but it's down, isn't it? There's only loss. they don't teach you about how the body naturally lets go of weight and that plateauing is normal. I was talking to a friend who's a personal trainer, and she was talking me through how the body works. It's like, why don't I know this? I'm 50, how old am I? 56, I'm 56. I did not know this. You just assume that it's supposed to like go up or go down, you know, in that linear way. That's not how losing weight works.
And it can also take quite a long time. And so that also ties in quite well with the whole mindful eating thing. So it is about slowing down and being more conscious, but also letting go of that urgency around losing weight. I mean, how many books are there on the shelves that say lose a stone in a month? And it's like, it's just mad. Lose a stone in a month, put two on in 2 months. You know, that's because that's basically what happens to
and
more
go
than
slightly do lally in the meantime, because where's your brain's nutrients going to come from?
But I think it is really important, whilst we're sort of bashing dieting, is to say, well, with the benefit of hindsight, where I am now, I can say that. But at the time, it seemed like it was the right thing to do. And it seems like it's the right thing to do for lots and lots of people.
Everybody has their wake up moment, don't they? When they realize it's not them, it's the process. I mean, like Einstein said, like, you know, the definition of madness is doing the same over and over again and expecting a different result. Yeah. And they'll promise you with their highly manipulative marketing techniques that they're different. But it's just another way of pushing you towards practices that can't sustain you in the long term.
Yes.
And even if you get to the other end, you're then trapped in the like, how do I maintain this? How do I keep this going?
How do I do half a diet?
Yes. There's no maintenance, is there?
No.
How do you live post? And if you stuck a carrot at the end of your diet, like a wedding or something like that, you know, losing weight to fit into something for a big, potentially celebratory, oblique, shaming event. If that's what you need, as soon as you've reached the carrot, you know, nobody says, and this is how you move forward together.
Well, I think to be fair to some of them, they do have a maintenance suggestion, but it is still a diet. And the fundamental thing is, if you are eating with your head, then you're not eating correctly. Now, your head obviously plays a part in that. You know, you might fancy something different, and that's going to come into your mind. But in terms of, you know, when you're eating and how much you're eating, that message shouldn't come first of all from your head. It should come, you know, from your body. So then I decided that I was going to try and help other people, and I experimented a little. So I just put out there, right, this is what I'm thinking of doing. Anybody would like to have a few free chats with me, I will give them the benefit of my experience. Take it or leave it. I won't charge you. See what you think. Give me some feedback. I spoke to two young women who got back to me, and where they got to was extremely positive. So one was a serial dieter and one was a binge eater. And then I thought, crikey, yeah, I can do this. So I started tentatively posting on Facebook and Instagram. And then I thought, right, I need to formalize this. So I've done some diplomas in eating psychology, and I already had my NLP. So that was quite helpful. And then I've done a nutrition and weight management diploma as well. And I've got another couple up my sleeve that I'm doing this year. Just to have something robust underpinning my experiences. And I just looked into more widely different movements. So to understand more about the health at every size movement and the intuitive eating movement. And I have selected the bits that I believe are the most helpful from those and created my own approach. And that's where I am now with the Mindful Eating Clinic, which, thanks to lockdown, has been quite busy because I've been developing my online and digital presence because there's no other way of seeing people. And it's now basically, from what I thought was going to be a face-to-face business, is now 90% an online business.
You've got a couple of programs, haven't you, that you can just purchase from the website?
Yeah,
you do other sort of variants of that as well.
Yeah, so most of my clients come to me for one-to-one coaching, and there are various combinations of hours. I always talk to everybody for 20, 30 minutes beforehand, because firstly, I need to make sure that I'm the right person to help them, really. Because if I've thought that somebody needed a psychotherapist to help them with a particular eating disorder, then I wouldn't touch that, because that's a whole different skill. If somebody's looking for nutrition help to fix a particular condition, then likewise, I'm not qualified to do that. So I've got some nutritionist colleagues that I point them to. So we have that conversation, and then they can do one-to-one, which is where I can really get under the skin and help people. And normally 4 to 6 sessions is what people have, and they never come back. So I'm a victim of my own success.
That's invariably the issue, is it? It's the same with hypnotherapy. You know, they don't come out, "Oh, I think I want to do some more. It's so much fun."
They come
to you with an issue. You help them with the issue, and then they're off. And your best, fingers crossed, is they tell their friends.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, that's why I do it. That's why I started it. And I just felt like I couldn't not do it. I mean, the pull to not just sit back and live my nice, happy life with food. I just couldn't do that. I absolutely had to. It's the biggest passionate driver of anything I've ever had in my life to do it. And then, yes, there are some DIY courses online that people can just follow in their own time. And then I've got a monthly club that people can join, and we have a Facebook group, and we chat. And sometimes those people will be existing clients that want to feel part of a community. So they come on and just share how the week's gone. And then others, for whatever reason, one-to-one isn't available to them. So that's quite a good way for them to come on and just have a little bit of me each week and a few tips. And I upload some documents, and then they go away for a week and come back. But really, to get to the heart of it, the one-to-one is obviously much better, because I can have a real bespoke approach with people and understand them properly.
It's also just the fastest. If you're like me and you just want to get something sorted, it's just the, you know, I mean, I do group yoga, I do one-to-one yoga, but you know that your growth in a group, it's lovely, and you're in a community of people who feel the same way, and it can be very isolating. I completely get that. But if you want to get the job done, one-to-one, I've always found, is the fastest way to get there.
Absolutely. Because people can ask me questions, and they also share a lot more, of course, one-to-one. Mm. And the more they can tell me about how they think and how they feel around food or around what's going on around them. You know, some people don't have a particularly good support structure, and they need help managing people, which is where my corporate training and coaching and communication and that kind of world comes in. So I can help them articulate what they want to articulate, so that other people don't sabotage what they're trying to do.
Because we don't live in isolation, some of us do, but not everybody lives on their own. They're surrounded by people who invariably might have the one thing in common with them that they're trying to manage.
And yes,
if you've got any empathy for the person that you share space with, you're not going to want to be constantly rejecting them. And it's learning that language, isn't it, of saying no to people in a way that doesn't make you feel like you felt as a small child when somebody was saying no to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's a big learn for a lot of people, I can imagine.
Especially if they're the person that cooks, and their feeding is also their love language, you know, so it can get really quite complicated. So all those sorts of things also sometimes come up, but it is an absolute, it's just an absolute joy to take people through this process and to have them say things like, I never thought I could get here. I never thought that I wouldn't have food in my head all day. I thought I might lose a bit of weight, but I had no idea that I would uncover and sort out lots of hidden feelings around food and myself. And, you know, I just sit there just with a great big grin on my face, because that's exactly what I started it for. Exactly that.
It's not like, I mean, you know, it's definitely food addiction. And there's many, many reasons why some foods are more addictive than others. But it's not like cigarettes, where you can just like step away from.
Yeah.
You don't just like step away from smoking.
No, but
you can choose not to buy cigarettes. Yeah. You can't choose not to buy food.
That's the problem. Exactly. If you have an issue, difficulty with alcohol, drugs or smoking, you can just eradicate them from your life. But somehow we have to manage this thing called food and eating. Mm. Somehow, because we need it to sustain ourselves, and that's why it's so challenging, you know, and why trying to show people a way that can start to feel normal for them, which is actually what most people want. I just want to be normal. How do people do it? How do people just not eat? I mean, you know, you know, gradually we unpick this, and they do get to a point where they say, you know, I didn't wake up. Today's the first day I didn't wake up worrying whether I was going to eat more than I should all day. Just little things like that just make such a massive difference to some people.
It's a huge stepping stone, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not being haunted by your gremlin 24/7.
Yeah.
So if you're soothing yourself with food, although it sounds like, you know, it's more like attempting to stick a plaster over something that sounds like quite a deep wound by the sound of it. But in terms of looking after yourself now, I guess you're not getting in the car and pursuing chocolate. What are your self-care go-tos now, Laurie?
I like being so outside of food or food, or did you mean both? What did you mean?
Outside, well, outside of food.
So I love my garden. So I'm fortunate enough to have a big garden that I spend a lot of time in. And this whole process has made me very mindful about lots of things. So I'll be gardening, and I find myself visually dissecting, you know, the plant that I'm caring for, and looking at the petals and just getting quite lost in it. So I do quite a lot of that. I took up yoga very late in life, only about 18 months ago. And I do that a couple of times a week. I'm not very good at doing it on my own. So I probably need some work on that. Yes. I still sing. So I will take half an hour out and find a nice accompaniment and do a bit of classical singing, just let rip. And that's quite good. So that's really my self-care. But this is going to sound really, really cheesy, but it's absolutely true. I love working. Mm-hmm. So I don't find that difficult or burdensome, particularly the work that I'm doing now. And so I actually feel a lot less in need of a lot of self-care, because I feel quite content and happy and hugely rewarded by the work I'm doing. I do.
What prompted the thought was, I went for my breast cancer diagnosis thing, you know, where they squash your chest into
that really hurts. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure those machines were not invented by a woman.
Because
there seems to have been little thought given to how uncomfortable and just undignified the whole process is, really.
I agree.
I'd come out of it and it had been in a mobile hut that I'd had problems finding. And I thought, oh, I'm just going to, you know, go and get myself something to just offset how deeply unpleasant I found that. You know, like when you're on the verge of tears for no good reason. It's all just been a bit overwhelming, really.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, I'm going to go and buy some flowers. So I trotted off to the flower shop and was talking to the woman. And I was saying, like, oh, I'm just buying. She's saying, oh, who are they for? And I was like, oh, they're for me. You know, they're a gift for myself. And I said, because I used to just like buy myself, you know, I don't want to make myself feel better with food or chocolate or anything like that. I want to buy something that just looks like lovely that I can gaze at. And then I realized what I'd inadvertently done was suggested that, like, that's what she did. Or, and that's the problem with the language of food, isn't it? You could just be talking about yourself and saying, oh, I used to buy chocolate all the time, but lockdown, you know, it's got to stop at some point. And she's going like, well, you know, some of us don't really worry about what we look like. And
I was like, oh gosh,
oh dear, I've triggered somebody here.
Well, yeah,
it's easy done, isn't it?
I think that was probably more about what she is thinking and feeling than anything else. And she,
I know,
you know, I just think sometimes people will receive things in a certain way, and it's all about their processing and their filtering system. And you know, you meant it with the best of intentions.
I know. You try to be a little ray of light in a world where people are a bit overwhelmed, and sometimes my Aryan size tends to just get into my mouth. Can't be helped, can it?
No, apparently. Exactly. Oh dear.
But
you enjoyed the flowers.
That's the most important thing. And to be fair, she did pick me some. I've no idea what they're called because my mother's the gardener in our family, and my grandfather was an amazing gardener as well. But they've got big heads, and they're either pink or blue.
Hydrangeas,
a couple of those, and some beautiful green frondy things. So they look very elegant.
Nice.
Yes, I do like them.
Yeah.
So as well as self-care, you're talking about this stack of diet books that you've binned from the past.
Yes.
What are your favourite books your go-tos, the one that was like a big revelation for you? Doesn't have to be about mindful eating, but I'm always fascinated about books.
You see, I'm not a brilliant fiction reader, although in my time I've devoured a huge amount of 19th century fiction. So that's what I like. I like all that old-fashioned stuff. I like getting lost in the principles of the time and the social history of the time and the protocols. And so, you know, Trollope, Hardy, Dickens less so, but Jane Austen, George Eliot, all of that stuff. I think there's a little old-fashioned romantic in me somewhere. I read very little contemporary fiction because this is going to sound really awful. I'm really sorry to anyone who loves it. But I read these books and I just don't care. I just don't care about the characters, you know, Peggy and Sue that run the coffee shop and Mr. Jones comes. And I just think, because I'm so busy, which is what I love to be. I'm not saying that because it's fantastic or anything, but just because I don't have that much time, if I'm going to read something, I want to be really caught in the drama.
You want it to count.
Yes, I do, and I just wanted to have a bit more depth. I certainly don't want to read anything that makes me laugh. No, I want to get really quite lost in something quite intense. That's why I like Hardy, because he doesn't know what a happy ending is, you know. Poor old Tess. Is it never gonna get better? Nope, it's never gonna get better, you know. And it's but I do, what I do read actually is I read some of these lovely new-ish magazines like Simple Things and OOH and Breathe. I love those because they have a lot of mindfulness articles and they're all about lovely things, and they're very peaceful. and they're printed on matte paper, not gloss, and there's something quite aesthetically restful and slow about it. I can't really describe it, and the colours are quite muted. So I just love to sit outside with one of those and a bottomless cup of tea and just work through one
of those. It sounds idyllic. Yeah, there's a lot to be said for people like Kathy from Wuthering Heights, isn't there?
Oh, I know. Just great.
She's such a fury.
Well, that's just a fantastic story.
I mean, yeah.
Heathcliff is, you know, he's so deep. Anyway, don't get me started.
Oh, I know. That's
it'll be like
it happens all over again with their kids as well. How amazing is that?
Well, like, yeah, well, exactly.
Which would be your desert island book if you could only like take one of those great classics away with you?
Okay, well, there are some quite cliche ones, I suppose. So I must have read Pride and Prejudice loads and loads of times, and I know what happens, but it doesn't really matter. Interestingly, I'm going to slightly go against what I said now. I remember reading Captain Corelli's Mandolin, and I happened to finish it on the beach. Now, I don't really go on holiday very much, but I know we happened to be on the beach in the Algarve, and I was with my husband, and our twins were quite young then, and I just said, I'm on the last chapter, you have to take them away. And I just remember sitting on the beach between these two massive rocks and reading the last chapter and just blubbing in this wonderful setting. And I think because it's set on the island and it's, you know, and I just won't ever forget reading the end of that book.
It's kind of time and place one. I know what you mean.
I think so, yeah. I think so. But these days I tend to listen to books more, and I like them dramatised, which I think goes back to my acting roots. So I listen to a lot of BBC 4 dramatisations when I'm gardening or when I'm out walking, and get quite lost in the narrative and the drama.
They're very good, aren't they? I've become an audible convert over lockdown. And some of them I listen to over and over again. And it's like I even know where I was the last time I listened to.
Yes. I mean, the brain's incredible like that because it can compartmentalise. I think I've got 3 on the go at the moment, and I find myself actually able to dip in. But I think I like them because you can do something else at the same time.
Yeah.
Just sitting reading a novel, this is probably something I need to work on, feels quite self-indulgent, which it isn't at all. But for me, it feels like just sitting doing one thing, reading a novel. In my head, I've got lots of other things that I not should, but could be doing and possibly would like to be doing more or want to be doing to get them out of the way. Whereas the audible.
Sorry.
Whereas the audible, you know, you can be out, you feel like you're doing more than one thing at once.
And that's what I've always thought was so irritating about television, even before we had wonderful things like Audible, you know, and I'd just listen to Radio 4 and drag it around the house with me. Before we had digital and anything exciting like that.
Yes.
It just gave you the capacity to do something else. And it's just how amazing. Why would you sit and just watch a box, you know, for hours and hours of time?
Unless it's got subtitles, you can't really do very much else. But I've normally got some crochet on the go when I'm watching television.
You're a big crocheter, aren't you?
I am.
I see these outfits that are on Instagram periodically. It's like, oh, another green cardigan.
Thing. Yes. Well, it's my brand. What can I say?
It's
not all green. Not everything I make is green. But yes, so my daughter learned when she was in hospital having some hip surgery. We have this family hip difficulty.
I've had a hip replacement.
I have you
on the hip front, yeah.
Which side?
Left.
Yeah.
So it makes an L.
So mine's left as well, but it's resurfaced.
All right.
Haven't had the full jobby yet. But my daughter needed some surgery on both hers, so she had reshaping. So she hasn't had anything metal put in so far. But anyway, so she learned to crochet from a friend of mine, very good friend of mine. And then Phoebe, my daughter, then taught me to crochet. And that was about 8 years ago. And now it's there's always a Paulo Crochet by my chair in the living room.
Very soothing, isn't it? That touching of wool.
Yeah.
I taught myself to knit, you know, and you're just like, I'm very, very bad. I have no talent. There's nothing like a cardigan ever going to emerge from my knitting. But I just love the touching of it and the rhythm and the repetitiousness.
Yeah. I think the rhythm is very soothing, actually. Mm. And people can't see, but I'm doing this weird thing with my fingers, imagining that I've got yarn running through my fingers. Yeah. And of course, it's actually, and this sounds a bit oversimplistic, but sometimes I'll say to people that just have this voice in their head about eating in the evening, say, okay, so we're going to have a conversation with our head, but that's going to take a bit of time. So let's have a look at some practical things. And so they might pick up a craft that they haven't done for years because it's keeping their hands busy and they're thinking about something else. And sometimes it's just a tiny practical tip like that, really, you know, that makes the difference. But yes, it is. You can just lose yourself in it, can't you? And then if you create something half decent at the end, then that's the bonus, really.
In your case, yes. In my case, it's just like a length of like knitted stuff that looks a bit tight.
I'm sure it's not that bad at all.
Mm.
Anyway, I do quite a lot of unpicking to get to the point that you see on Instagram.
Oh, yeah. That's so good to hear.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Or frogging, as we call it in the crochet world.
Oh,
I don't know why it's called. Maybe someone can tell me why it's called frogging, but it is. That's, you know, I don't know.
It's that unraveling in crochet world.
Yeah.
Fucking.
Yeah.
Interesting. From this place where you are now, so you're 50, you're in your 50s.
I'm 59.
59. So 60 coming up.
I'm planning it now, baby.
Are you? Excellent.
Yeah.
My first question, I know if I thought, that's my second question, but like I have to do them in order because otherwise I'll just get confused.
All right.
My first question was going to be, from where you are now, Laurie, at 59 on the border of 60, what do you wish you knew when you were little Laurie that you know now?
I think, I don't know about little Laurie, but I think young adult Laurie, I think it would be to try and just do what you want to do and not worry about what people think and not worry about conforming and not being brave. I don't think I really tapped into what I wanted. I don't think for quite a long time, I sort of fell into jobs. I mean, I was always very good at seizing opportunities because I'm a born optimist. And I also have quite serious FOMO. I didn't realise what it was when I was in my 20s, but I realised that's what it was.
FOMO with my friend's kids said, like, oh, yeah, in case you have FOMO. And you're like, what is that? FOMO, fear of missing out.
Fear of missing out.
You don't know it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I learned that from my daughter. So, yes, it is a generational thing. I think it's that. Just to try and tap into who you are and what you want. I mean, I do wonder whether I either didn't hear it, didn't know it, or maybe it just wasn't there until I got to a certain age. I don't really know, you know. And I mean, all the things I've done have really contributed to the person that I am. I've had some great jobs and moved around, and you know, I think from every experience, even the most painful, there is something that you can say, right, what am I going to take from it? And it might be what I'm not going to put up with moving forward, or the space that I want to put myself in, and what I need to thrive. And so I don't have any regrets about it, but I think I have worried too much about perhaps conforming and what people think. I don't quite know where that came from.
I don't think we're taught at school, though, are we, that thinking about an experience and is this right for us, and being able to step back and evaluate. It's just like there's no conversation about that at school. It's just like absorbing information and then going
and being
a drone bee, you know.
Exactly. I don't know whether it's any different now, but certainly, I mean, no teachers would say, what what kind of personality do you think you have? What kind of person do you think you are? What kind of what kind of feelings do you have about yourself now, or where you want to be? I mean, can you imagine that just wouldn't have happened, would it?
I remember my careers conversation and they said to me, would you, well, you're quite good at languages, would you like to be an air hostess or maybe a courier?
Inspired, yes.
but I like writing, I want to be a journalist, you know, and I'd read a newspaper. I mean, I was reading newspapers quite young, but I used to lie on the floor as a kid with the news of the world when it used to be a broadsheet, because that's how old I am. And I was just fascinated by these stories of people and their crimes and these things that they've been up to that I didn't understand, but were clearly a big deal. And I just wanted to be part of that, this telling of stories. And that evolved.
So how old were you when you first felt that then?
About 8, I would say.
That's pretty young, isn't it?
I didn't think, oh, I want to do this. I didn't understand what this was. I mean, like, you know, my dad was a lorry driver. My mum worked in a bank. There wasn't anybody who'd done A-levels in our family. Never mind.
Yeah,
got on into uni or done. You know, my mum was supposed to go to uni, but it wasn't, there were no grants when my mum, you know, in the 50s. So she couldn't go because there just wasn't the money for her to go to uni. And for me, learning has always been such a privilege, and I've always been so excited to learn more things. And I think, you know, I knew when I was at school that my attitude to school wasn't how other kids' attitudes to school was. I was like, well, this is for a purpose and I want to do this, so therefore I'm going to try really hard and then I'm going to try and get there. I had a plan. The plan hasn't always gone to plan, and I've had ups and downs along the way, like everybody else has. But I'm just interested in why we don't educate young people to make informed choices for themselves. We're just so busy trying to funnel them into, you know, corridors of what suits.
Well, I suppose it's because there are so many of them partly for practical reasons, there has to be a blanket approach up to a certain point, doesn't there? But I think that from the point of teenage years, surely when they start to develop, when they go through puberty and they start to have all sorts of feelings and emotions about themselves and how they fit in the world, at that point, I think those conversations should happen. I mean, maybe it's better now. I think the pastoral care is better, and they have, what's the topic, PHSE, I can't even remember what it stands for now, but, you know, those more individual conversations, I think, probably happen. But I don't think schools can really even really start to think about proper career guidance, because, as you say, they are so caught up, aren't they, in numbers and targets and trying to get all the children through. But, you know, there are a lot of kids out there, and I have several friends who are teachers, and it is really hard work,
I imagine.
And they do the best they can within the framework that they have, and I think the framework has to exist, otherwise it would just be chaos, you know. But, you know, maybe it's about making those conversations more available at home where it's possible, and I think perhaps young people knowing that there are other places that they can go to have those conversations, even if it's not with their teachers
during school.
I
did a lot of drama school stuff when I was you know, like in the summer holidays and so that sort of thing. And I know you have like a performance background, don't you? Was that something you were doing at school as well? Or
I started when I was about 12. So I just joined the local amateur dramatic group in Purbright, down near Woking in Surrey, for anyone who knows that neck of the woods. So I'm a Woking girl. And my mother and I joined, and I stayed until I went to university. And I think there was one production where the whole family was in it. So, and I'm just trying to think. I think it was Cinderella. It's one pantomime, Cinderella. And so I think my mother, yeah, so my mother was the stepmother, you know, in charge of the two ugly sisters. And we had some great men in the village who were fantastic. So they played the ugly sisters. And I was Cinderella. My brother was Buttons. And my sister was Cinderella's sidekick. I think it was slightly creative, you know, this story. And my dad was stage manager. So we were and that's a very fond memory of mine. And my brother, I remember my brother saying, never again. And then my sister said, never again. Whereas I'm going, oh, but it's so fantastic. I want more. So they didn't do it ever again. But then so I just carried on doing that. And then singing was always my thing, really. Mm-hmm. So I just studied privately. And got up to diploma level and did a bit of semi-pro stuff, and it's just always been a part of me, really. But I also did some musical theatre in my 20s, 30s and half of my 40s, and then when I then got to early 40s, I picked up with another classical singing teacher who said, right, well, I don't know why you're singing all this musical theatre stuff, and I don't know why you're singing half an octave down from where you should be, because you're actually an operatic soprano. And so she unleashed this top voice, and then I joined a couple of amateur opera groups and got really into singing things like Mozart and Donizetti and all of that. So I don't sing musical theatre anymore, because it's quite difficult to do both. You know, you have to do it properly. Well, properly. But So I know the whole performance thing. And then at university, I did French and drama. Drama wasn't really the right thing for me. I really should have been doing musical theatre, a kind of jazz hands show off degree course, really. That's the one I should have been on, I think.
A friend of mine did drama at Warwick, and she does this hilarious impression of, I think she did drama and dance, and she does this impression of like Peter Bausch dancing with like a chair that just like scoots around the room, which makes no sense to anyone unless they know who Peter Bausch is, and she's super niche, it has to be said. But yeah, it's, I think it takes a very particular person, doesn't it, to go into drama as a profession, acting.
I think so. I mean, I did go to some auditions in my 20s, but I just couldn't cope. I mean, I didn't have a very thick skin at all and couldn't cope with the environment and the no's and the thank you. You know, you kind of open your mouth and that's it. I mean, it just was awful. And
didn't get to like say a word. They'd just be like,
No, exactly. And of course, the problem is that they want rounded performance. So I was always there or thereabouts with the singing, acting not bad. And then they say, right, now we're going to do the dance audition. Oh no, this is where it all falls apart. Because with my hip, you know, my balance was never particularly good. And I could get steps, but I get them half an hour after everyone else. You know, I'd need to go through it 20 times. But these people who'd also done dance since they were tiny, they'd see a routine once and they'd have it like this.
Yeah.
And of course, when you're on stage, you can fake the singing, you can get away with the acting. One thing you cannot fake is the dancing. So those roles where all of it was required, I never got. I thought, oh God. And I got to a second call with the Cirque du Soleil once. And then we had to move. So I didn't get any further. And I thought, oh God, this is not what I'm gonna do. So I went into work, and I had a lovely, lovely amateur stroke semi-pro career. And I've played most of the musical theatre leads because it was amateur, and that has been wonderful. And I would never have done any of that if I'd persevered and tried to go pro in any capacity. So it was absolutely the right thing for me. I could be a big fish in a small pond, and that suited me much, much better.
Oh, so many other talents anyway. You don't have to have all your eggs in one basket.
No,
do you?
No. No, exactly. I mean, I'm just lucky to have had the opportunity, really, you know, because it's certainly helped me in my training and coaching career, because standing up in front of an audience was easy, really, for me. And that's only because I've been doing it from such a young age. I didn't really think about it. And that's why I think that it's so important for children and young people to be exposed to drama at school, where they have to develop this awareness of how they're presenting themselves and projecting their voice and getting over those nerves, because they need them at university. If they're presenting, they need them for job interviews. Most corporate environments, they'll have to present something at some point to their team or to their managers. And it's just so short-sighted for schools or the government or whoever to be saying, actually, you know, the arts come down here because
we want this. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Because they're not this. Although, interestingly, I was talking to a head teacher client of mine, because my daughter is about to train to be a music teacher. She's just done her master's and she's decided to go into teaching. And I said to him, can I just ask you, what is the state of the arts at the moment in school? Because we hear various stories. Mm. And he said, well, actually, Ofsted are very keen on a broad curriculum, and that because the arts have not been taught the last year, because it's very difficult, of course, to do it online, he thinks there'll be a real push to make sure that those art subjects come back, and that therefore he thinks that there's going to be a good environment for music teachers. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah.
Very. So 60 coming up, Laurie.
Yeah.
I was going to say, are you a woman who like goes with the flow, or are you a planner? But now that you've got 60 coming up and you just said, oh yes, I've got this like idea, I'm guessing that you probably are a planner in a way.
Yes, I am a planner, actually. Do I like surprises? No, I don't. I'm just imagining, for my husband was here in this room, he'd say, are you joking? I don't like people turning up if I don't know that they're coming, because I like everything to be the way I like it, you know. And yeah. So my friends plan about 3 months in ahead, and his friends plan about 3 days, you know, that if I'm lucky, you know. So this is a point of contention often. So yes, I am a planner, but I don't really know what I mean, I will drag it out for the entire year, I can tell you that much, and make the most of it and milk it at every opportunity. I may have a gathering, because we've got some space up here, so I might try and get some of my old friends and newer local friends to come, and we'll have a bit of a bash. I was driving home from somewhere and Stevie Wonder Superstition came on the radio. Oh. And I thought, I think I need to have a disco on my birthday. I need to have a disco. So I think it might be a 70s, 80s disco.
Fabulous. Think,
which would be great. But I won't have it around my birthday, because that's end of February. I think I'd quite like to have it outside. So I'll probably have it in the summer.
I was going to say, do you have like a favourite song or song lyric or poem or saying?
Oh, gosh. Ooh, that's a tricky one. There's a Lord Tennyson, Alfred Lord Tennyson poem, and I think the last two lines are something like, come into my bosom and be lost in me, which I rather like. It's less like kind of sense of enveloping somebody. I don't know the whole poem. I'm a sucker for anything with quite deep romantic lyrics. I was listening to Billy Joel yesterday, and his song "And So It Goes," and I think the opening verse is, "In every heart there is a room, a sanctuary safe and strong." See, it's going to make me cry. I can't say it. To heal the wounds of lovers past until a new love comes along, and I will dare to share this room with you. No. And I will choose to be with you as if the choice were mine to make. So I will share this room with you, and you can have this heart to break. and words like that, and they just make me go, "Oh, yeah, funny." So I'm a real sucker for that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah, because I like to think about the narrative behind it, I think, and so I like songs that have a story, and I can imagine the people maybe saying the words to each other and imagine what the setting might be, and you know, my head gets lost into
the story of the romance.
In the story, yeah.
So a bit like a Hardy novel.
You see, it all comes down to bonnets and petticoats at the end, doesn't it, really?
My partner, Gary, he like has a, I'm quite sure he would just like be nodding if he could hear, but he loves Eustacia Vye.
Yes.
I remember him saying, "You need to read this," and I'm thinking, "This woman's bonkers. Yeah. What is going on here?" Yeah. Yeah, she's a real heroine for him.
Yeah. Oh, lovely.
Yeah. No, so I like much drama.
So much drama. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Laurie, that's amazing. Thank you very much for your time. We've been chatting over an hour.
It's been lovely to talk about my stuff, your stuff, other stuff. No, it's been lovely. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Laurie. I've really enjoyed it. I knew I would. This little ray of sunshine whenever I open up Instagram. I can see you like smiling and like looking. You've even got gifts going on, haven't you? And that's like worth.
I have got gifts going
gifts
on.
And stickers. Yeah.
Yeah. That was quite a mad, nerdy moment. I was just curious to know how to make them. FOMO, you see.
Exactly. And if you don't try these, I think that's one of the wonders of midlife, isn't it? You're just like, I'm just going to try it, see if it works. If it doesn't work.
That's it. That's it. And it just doesn't matter anymore because the outward expectation is different.
Mm.
And I think we're much more patient with ourselves and hopefully kinder to ourselves. And it's a great time to be alive. I love it.
I think it's the best. Myself, I was something popped up on YouTube this morning and I was like, oh, this is quite interesting. It was four women singing, they're probably comedians off the telly, and it's just that I don't watch enough telly to know who anybody is these days. And they were singing the tune of Bohemian Rhapsody, but with lyrics that were about menopause and how their ovaries had died and they were past their prime.
And wasn't a group called Fascinating Aida, was it?
I don't know. They didn't look, they looked like they,
they're young.
They weren't singing particularly in tune though. So I think Fascinating Aida are quite tuneful, aren't they?
Yes.
I know those ladies. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're like listening to it and you're going like, but you're not past your prime. This is rubbish. You're going to have an amazing time. I don't think they're perimenopause. They were on the other side. They would know that things are getting better. And they're just like listening to the noise of people telling them who to be.
Well, exactly. And if you listen to that and you say it to yourself, then it's self-perpetuating. You know, so much of this, how we live and how we embrace life is about mindset. Oh, my God. We have a choice, don't we, as to how we decide to look at things, how we receive things, what we do with the comments from other people, like your florist lady. You know, at that moment you have a choice and you can make your day better or worse depending on how you respond.
And it's that realizing, well, it's mindfulness, isn't it? It's realizing that you're in a moment and you have a choice to do X or do Y, and you do not have to absorb everything like you're a sponge.
No.
Right, on that note, Molly.
I know.
Molly, who's Molly? Laurie. I can't remember. At that point, Laurie, I'd just like to say thank you very much again.
My pleasure. Like
spun off on another tangent.
Thank you.
See you again very soon. Thanks
you will.
A lot.
Bye-bye.
And here we are, at the end of another edition of the Wise Life podcast. If you found this content useful, I would be very grateful if you could support this podcast by giving me a 5-star rating, and if you've got the time, a review would be amazing. And please, if you have suggestions for podcast topics, I'd love to hear them. Just DM me on Instagram @dina.morris and have a great week.